You would have heard a discussion with train driver and author Thomas Wolfenden, whose book is about a post-apocalyptic world, One Man's Island. And my next guest is also interested in a post-apocalyptic world. We used to, when I was growing up in the 80s, they were all the result of course, nuclear war post-apocalyptic worlds. But now we imagine a post-apocalyptic world of an apocalypse brought on simply by having had our fridge on too much. Would it all be our fault if we wipe ourselves off the planet? Could we wipe ourselves off the planet? And how do civilizations make themselves collapse? That's what Ted Lefroy has brought in for breakfast. He's the director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania. Hello, Ted.
Morning, Rick.
Lovely to have you in this morning for this chat about whether we actually could bring on our own apocalypse. I mean, civilizations tend to eventually eat themselves.
They have. There's a history of collapse, and there's a fascination amongst humans about why civilizations collapsed. And increasingly I meet people, young and old, who have this nagging concern that they think there's some inevitability that will undermine the basis of our own existence, that some sort of environmental catastrophe is almost inevitable. Because we do hear a lot of bad news, and bad news makes more press. And but I think there's some interesting historical analyses that point in a slightly different direction.
So can we look at, I mean, are there any examples in the natural world of populations that manage to consistently stabilize themselves? Or do populations, I don't know, of ants or whales or viruses or something always eventually undermine their own civilization?
No, I don't think we can take lessons from that, because humans being humans, you know, we're quite capable of doing things for ourselves. But there was a book that caused quite a bit of fuss a while ago. It was just called Collapse: Why Societies Choose to Succeed or Fail, by Jared Diamond. And he had case studies from 11 different societies, and he examined the basis for their demise. But the interesting thing, if you read the introduction, you realize he only picked societies where he thought environmental damage was the cause. And so when you read that, you think there was some sort of inevitability. There's a much earlier work, 25, nearly 30 years ago, a historian called Joseph Tainter was interested in this idea of collapse. And he looked at 18 different civilizations. And through his reading, he found there were a dozen different reasons as to people had speculated why that. And resource depletion or environmental damage was one of them, and one of the most popular. But he wasn't convinced. So he looked at them all against these 12, and the conclusion he came to was really very interesting, and there are lessons for us. What he concluded was a lot of these factors occurred, such as internal dispute and war with neighbours, and just social dysfunction or catastrophe, but environmental damage was a factor in some. But the thing that struck him is why societies bring themselves to their knees is a declining return on investment in their complexity. In other words, they get too big that they can't maintain what they've built. And Rome was a classic case where most of their wealth came from conquest, and they were so spread out with garrisons at all corners of their empire that maintaining that, they put an increasing tax burden on the residents in the centre, particularly the peasants, and that eventually collapsed inward. So it wasn't the tribes from the north. It's like if you meet someone with an infectious disease, you're not inevitably going to get it. If you're run down, you're more likely to get it. They were run down and they succumbed to raids, but it was the fact that they had built this empire on a very narrow base. And
so does that mean in the West, because I think the sense is, isn't it, that the East is rising and the West is destabilized or shrinking or becoming weak? And hence, you know, there is political will for some Western governments to be tougher and, you know, look stronger and be harder. Barack Obama's been criticized in the United States for sounding weak about foreign policy, saying, hey, let's not go to war. Let's concentrate on our own problems.
But when you say China's right, I mean, China's just coming back to where it was, its rightful place. It was the biggest and most powerful economy in the world.
And only how long ago? Not so long ago.
No, it's only just prior to the Industrial Revolution. But just getting back to the environment, while it's a factor, the interesting thing is, so even with the Mayan civilization, which puzzled people, it's built this enormously complex empire, and but it was all it all fell back on the peasants to maintain this huge and spiraling effort in building monuments and spreading out, and eventually it wouldn't sustain it. But where I think we have a huge advantage, it's not inevitable that we'll repeat these. You know, they say that history doesn't repeat itself, humans do. But the difference is we are better informed and we're much better connected. And so there are now cities around the world that are all learning from each other how they get over their problems to do with infrastructure, transport, dealing with waste, pollution. And that hasn't happened before in history. So connectedness at that level gives us a lot more reasons for optimism. So, you know, a lot of my friends are terribly pessimistic about the environment. And when they realise I'm not, they think that's wrong, just because that's my field. But so, I would encourage people to read some very thoughtful historical analyses and not believe all the environmental catastrophism that is about.
It's 18 to 7 on 936 ABC Hobart. You're waking up to Professor Ted Lefroy, who is giving you some hope. And maybe meaning all that work you did on your bunker over the weekend might have been wasted. I mean, our instinct to survival is very strong. And you can imagine a city-state is just one sort of individual unit. Mm. If it can't communicate or learn from other city-states, if everything is an enemy to it, it needs a small imbalance to put it out.
Mm.
And you're suggesting, I suppose, on a global scale, I mean, we may lose a city or two.
Mm. But I think the thing is, national governments are struggling because often the decisions they made, that the consequence of the decisions are so far from the centre, it takes them a long time to realise the perverse impacts of their policies. Cities, the people who make the decisions, live amongst the consequences. And there is much more hope in seeing the way. There's a network now called Resilient Cities. There's over 100 cities have signed up. And the rate at which they're learning from each other how to deal with, a large degree, environmental problems, doesn't mean we don't still have enormous social problems. You know, we still have to find the revenue base to support an ageing population and to maintain social welfare and health.
So
they're huge issues.
How do we do those things without taxing the peasants? Because that seems to be one of the key points, isn't it, where the civilization collapses. You ask too much from the people at the bottom.
Or you ask too much of a very small proportion of your society. So, in other words, Joseph Tainter's conclusion was it wasn't environmental destruction. It was declining investment on social and political complexity. So more and more of this great infrastructure relying on a smaller and smaller proportion of the population, which is very similar picture that we see today, isn't it, when you think about budgets being faced by nations all over the world. But that's where I say the difference we have is it's a much less violent place. We don't have to devote as much to protecting ourselves. And if people don't think the world is getting safer, there's a fabulous book called The Angels of Our Better Nature by Steven Pinker that won the Royal Society's Science Book Award of the Year in 2012. And he collects information from prehistory to the present showing this unmistakable decline in violence, even through this previous century. The number of people who die violently as a proportion of the total population has been decreasing throughout history. So we put less resources towards that, and we are now better connected and better informed. So, you know, a lot of the inevitable collapses have been a fascination of humanity, but, you know, I don't think they are inevitable. One thing I suggest to people as an anecdote to this non-specific anxiety is a book called The Idea of Decline in Western History. And it's fascinating. For 2,000 years, people have been saying it'll end in tears. So, it's something, that's why we love post-apocalyptic novels, because, you know, there's a conviction that it'll happen. But
that anxiety you describe that people live with, that Weltanschauung, it's real, and it can really colour people's whole experience of living. And if you live with someone who is convinced of the futility of everything, it's very hard to persuade them to renovate the bathroom. You know, so it's absolutely worth addressing. Is our idea of nature itself changing, though? There was an article in The Conversation I spoke about last week that said we've always seen nature as the sort of passive place we pollute, which it was then our job to save. But it's far from passive, and it's a system, in fact, that can kick back pretty hard, that may even be working to right itself.
Well, saying it rights itself, it gives it purpose. And that's a dangerous line to go down. But to say it's dynamic is absolutely right. And I think for a long time we've thought of it as a beautiful and passive backdrop. I think we're coming to terms with some of these consequences of our actions, but the problem is a lot of them occur outside human lifetimes or outside the cycle of human lifetimes.
So, such as the collapse of the ice shelf, which you hear news about and go, oh my goodness, and then they say yes, and in 75 years, and then my mind switches off.
Yeah, because these things occur, you know, the consequences of our action can take decades and decades, so it's outside our human lifespan. So it's taking a long time. Even within ecology, there were ideas of stability and order that went out of fashion about 60 or 70 years ago. But in the popular culture, they're still there, you know, about balance of nature. And we're still beginning
to
learn.
Does nature not have balance?
Sadly, Rick, no, it doesn't. It's dynamic and it's changing. Well, look, think about Darwin's big revelation in his book was that the earth changes and life adapts. He was basically a geologist. And he knew his geology, and everywhere he went, he saw signs that the Earth was dynamic, it's changing, and life adapts, and we get used to it. Now, the thing we've learned on top of that is we're capable of change, of meddling with some of those forces, and then we have to live with the consequences.
But we're capable of doing it.
We are, absolutely, and we're more and more capable as every decade passes.
Great to speak with you this morning. Professor Ted Lefroy, who is the director of the Centre of Environment at the University of Tasmania, asking the question this morning, will it all end in tears? Well, no, probably not, but it won't necessarily be very easy. And I think this is the perfect song to take us to the weather. Toots and the Maytals.